and other frequencies in the region. And we are going out to you via KBOO.FM. Click the tip jar and join KBOO, won't you? KBOO.FM. And in this manner, we reach all the ships at sea.
Citizens of a so-called democratic society, we need to have information that ranges from A to Z, not what we have, which is A to B.
KBOO is proud to present An Evening with David Barsamian, Wednesday, March 4th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. All proceeds will benefit KBOO Community Radio. One of America's most tireless and wide-ranging investigative journalists, David Barsamian is the host of Alternative Radio. Again, that's An Evening with David Barsamian, Wednesday, March 4th, at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, this is Sun Lee, KBOO's membership coordinator. I wanted to take a moment to thank you for becoming a member. Everyone at KBOO is grateful for your generosity, and without your support, we would not be able to provide you with the great news, music, and programming that you have come to expect from KBOO. If you haven't joined our community, please consider starting a monthly deduction by going to kboo.fm/give. Or you can call 503-231-8032. Thank you.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fograng, and the show is Fight the Empire. And today, my guest is Robert Parry, a longtime journalist and author. His latest book is America's Stolen Narrative, and he's also the editor and publisher of Consortium News. And you can go to Consortium News, and you can see all the articles he's written, and you can order the books he's written. And lately, he's been writing a lot about Ukraine. So that's what our topic will be today. Well, Robert Parry, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I have to say, there's not many people reporting on Ukraine the way you do. It's amazing. I mean, like I think you mentioned that you've never seen such a one-sided sort of media barrage as this one, and I have to agree with you. It's amazing. I've been around for quite a while. I remember media blitzes before, but this one really it seems overwhelming.
Yeah, I think it's even surprised me, and I've also been around for quite a while, and I've seen the mainstream press go charging off over cliffs many times. But this one is really quite extraordinary in just the unanimity of it. We saw, of course, back in 2002, 2003, that pretty much all the big news outlets had decided that Saddam Hussein had his weapons of mass destruction and was about to give them to Al-Qaeda, and they fell for every lie and deception that the Bush administration could give them. But here we're seeing almost across the ideological spectrum, this one-sided account of what's happening in Ukraine, which is really, there really are two sides to this story. And but the New York Times, the Washington Post, MSNBC, Fox News, everybody really across the spectrum has bought into this storyline that this was all part of some grand scheme by Russian President Putin to become the next Hitler, and that he sort of engineered this crisis and plans to take the Baltic states and march through Europe. I mean, there's no evidence of that. It goes against all the facts that we know, but it's become this groupthink that has been just, you cannot penetrate it with logic or facts or reason.
Is this the same thing as what's called the Washington Consensus?
It's sort of a conventional wisdom. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, there are certain things that all the important people just know to be true, and often they're not true. But I've been dealing with this, going back to the 1980s when we would have similar patterns developing under Ronald Reagan, and he would push he'd push the hot buttons, and you'd see a lot of the press falling into line. But there were always elements of the mainstream media that would do the job and sort of ask the questions and not just go with the flow. And as we've moved forward in time, I guess the number of people willing to put their careers at risk by asking those tough questions and not just playing along, that those people have disappeared, or there aren't as many of them. And so we see more and more of this everyone hopping on the bandwagon approach to, instead of giving the American people a balanced, fair, even-handed, objective view of what's going on in Ukraine. It's mm-hmm. been extraordinary.
Well, I remember when the Maidan protests were going on, we were getting, I listened to NPR quite a bit, and they'd have, a lot of us reports right from the square where all this was happening. And so, of course, it was one-sided. And then at one point they said, well, now we're going to, for another point of view, we're going to go to eastern Ukraine. I said, oh, boy, Well, they did, and they contacted some person at some think tank in eastern Ukraine, and the think tank was not, I don't think he was even Ukrainian. So basically he was getting the same point of view, just from a different place. And then a few days later, they did the same thing. They said, now we're going to go to see what they're talking about in Moscow. And the same thing there. They had some think tank, one of those American-Russian institutes or something or other, and you got the same point of view. It was just it was really amazing.
Yeah, and it's been that way from the beginning, and it's continued. And there are some key factual points that, especially as we come upon the first anniversary of the coup d'etat, it was February 20th of last year when there was the mysterious sniper fire that was actually initially aimed at the police and also at some demonstrators. But when the police were taking casualties, including several dead, as they were pulling back, there were other elements, these sort of very radical elements of the Maidan demonstrators that attacked, and apparently the police did fire back at that point. But the identity of those snipers has always been an important point to nail down, and the entire American press corps just jumped to the conclusion that it was firing by the police, ordered by the elected president Yanukovych, and it became a justification for his overthrow a couple days later. But as people have done more work on this, including some of the European officials, a number of journalists, even BBC had a piece just the other day that it appears that the sniper fire was coming from one of these right sector controlled buildings,
mm-hmm.
And that it, so the story was just wrong, and at least that's how it now appears. We still don't have all the answers, but you have those kinds of rushes to judgment that we've seen, that the American press corps seems particularly vulnerable to these days, where especially if the State Department is on one side, as has been the case here, the State Department, people like Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland has been pushing for regime change. She was even caught in a phone conversation with the U.S. Ambassador Pyatt in early February, talking about who should be the new leaders of Ukraine, how they're going to midwife this thing, as they put it. So you had this effort by the State Department to push for regime change in Ukraine, and the American press corps simply went along with every propaganda theme that the State Department was putting out, and there was very little skepticism, almost virtually none. We even have situations where, even though it was quite obviously a coup d'etat that occurred on February 22nd of last year, the New York Times did a retrospective on it a month or so ago, and just insisted there was no coup. I mean, they never dealt with any of the evidence that there was a coup. Like, for instance, the phone call, the intercepted phone call involving Nuland and the ambassador. So even when there's strong evidence of something, we've seen this blindness, or putting on blinders, I guess you might say, by the major news organizations. And they seem to think it is part of their job now to basically push the propaganda themes on the American people, rather than do their jobs and just report the facts as best they can and leave it there.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we've been seeing.
Yeah, I had that story about the snipers. It's from the BBC by Gabriel Gatehouse, called The Untold Story of the Maidan Massacre. And he interviews some guy who was given a rifle, and he was up in this conservatory building, which kind of overlooks the square. And so that is... I like to some of the other things that don't get reported. We keep hearing the people in eastern Ukraine talk as separatists, so that's something horrible. But, you know, you go back our own history, we supported separatists in Bosnia and Kosovo and South Sudan, and even going further back in Katanga and Taiwan, you know. So why are these people so bad?
Well, what we're really seeing is a civil war, and mm-hmm. I know that's not the way the New York Times and other major news outlets want to present it, but that's what we're seeing. The original lie, though, to this was that Russian President Putin initiated it. That simply isn't true,
mm-hmm.
And he basically had very little to do with this actually starting, and he had no reason, no motive to start it. Basically, this was a case where, going back to November of 2013, the European Union, Chancellor Merkel, was pushing this idea of an association agreement with Ukraine, which President Yanukovych was open to. But in November of 2013, Yanukovych got a report from these economic experts in Kiev that breaking these ties with Russia, which are historic and very profitable, would cost Ukraine $160 billion. And so he had to sort of stop and rethink this, and basically he didn't call it off. He just said, we have to go slower on this. We have to, you know, look at this more thoroughly. That set off angry demonstrations by people in Western Ukraine, mostly, who favored, you know, the ties with Europe. They wanted visa-free travel. They were hoping to sort of open themselves up in that way. And there were some extremists in Western Ukraine. Some of these neo-Nazi groups, which are real, began organizing in Lviv and creating these 100-man brigades, really, and shipping them into Kiev to sort of make the demonstrations more violent, be the muscle. None of this involved Putin. Putin was off at this point. He was in Sochi, overseeing the Olympics, the Winter Olympics, where he was trying to show that Russia is a modern society. He spent $40 billion on it. He was trying to, you know, say we can be part of the West. He was actually making overtures to the West and was very proud of his work with President Obama on Syria in 2013 and on Iran in 2013. So he was making all these actual gestures to be more part of the West. He didn't create the crisis in Ukraine. When you had Yanukovych overthrown on February 22nd, and there was questions about what would happen to the Russian naval base in Sevastopol, that's when he started getting involved. But he was more a reactor, not an instigator. But that was the big lie that started this off. Much as we had the big lie in Syria, or in Iraq, which was that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and was going to give them to Al-Qaeda, we had a similar big lie here. But everybody in Washington, official Washington, went along with it. And even Henry Kissinger, former Secretary of State has come out in an interview with Der Spiegel and said it's wrong to accuse Putin of instigating this. She went through pretty much what I just said, and said this was not something that Putin started. This is not Hitler marching through Europe. But that was the way it was pitched. That's the way it's been sold. And everything that's happened has been put into that prism, or through that prism of trying to make it a Russian aggression, when it's a very mixed story. And it's not a story where one side has all the correctness, but that's how it's been sold to the American people.
Well, now, Putin made his own offer to Ukraine, and I've never actually seen the EU's offer and the Russian offer compared, but I've heard that the Russian deal was a whole lot better for Ukraine.
Well, he offered $15 billion. This is roughly the time when Yanukovych was seeing some real problems with the European offer. The European offer also came with demands from the International Monetary Fund for what they called structural reforms. Now, what those structural reforms entailed was, as often is the case with the IMF, reduction in public spending, reduction in subsidies for heat and other things of that sort. In other words, and also reducing the value of the Ukrainian currency, which all would have made the lives of the Ukrainian people, who are among the poorest in that part of the world, even worse. So there was a political dynamic that what the EU was demanding was not, as part of this association, was to have essentially an austerity plan forced on people whose lives were already pretty austere. So Yanukovych balked at that, and this is when Putin said, "Well, we can offer you a better deal," which is not a warlike act. It is it's a political decision.
Mm-hmm.
And what really was a political problem was then transformed into a regime change situation. And once the regime change happened violently on February 22nd, that's when things shifted. And what you ended up with was really the Eastern Ukrainians, mostly ethnic Russians, who had elected Yanukovych. They were Yanukovych's political base, and they had seen their president overthrown in this coup d'etat, run by mostly Western Ukrainians, and they felt that they had been disenfranchised, and so they rose up, basically. They first, in demonstrations, similar to what the Maidan protesters did, they started doing in places like Donetsk and Luhansk, and instead of being treated like political protesters, they were deemed terrorists. And the new regime in Kiev mounted what it called an anti-terrorist operation against them, which involved, by the way, taking some of these neo-Nazi self-defense forces, as they called themselves back in the Maidan period, and putting them into the National Guard, and ultimately making them these what they call volunteer battalions. And those battalions were sent by the Kiev government into the East, because they were the fiercest fighters. These were neo-Nazis that were being thrown into the battle,
mm-hmm.
and they were vicious. And so what can you expect from the people of Eastern Ukraine but to resist that? So what we had was really a civil war breaking out. But in the if you take it in the view of the mainstream American press, it's all Russian aggression. Putin wants to be the next Hitler. He's trying to take over the Baltic states. Things that are basically being made up as they go. There's no evidence to support any of that.
Mm.
But they just say it, and it becomes the conventional wisdom, and anyone who says, hold it. Even Henry Kissinger is attacked for being a Putin apologist because he points to the fact.
Not our Henry, my gosh.
I know. So basically anybody who's sort of raised their hand and said, hold it, there's another side to this story, is then shouted down, and so people just go quiet, and the American people are left with a one-sided story, but a dangerous one.
Boy.
I mean, this is a case where we are talking about the United States going into on the border of Russia, nuclear-armed state, and actually taking sides in a civil war.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be a very dangerous moment.
Well, we are talking to Robert Perry, who's the editor and publisher of Consortium News, which is if you want to get the other side of the story, I really recommend you go to Consortium News. they talk a lot about, there's, I have to put in quotes, territorial integrity, and nobody said, how did Ukraine get its borders? My impression from what I've been able to find out is that for most of its history, Ukraine was never a nation. It was part of the Russian Empire, it was part of a Polish Empire, it was even part of a Lithuanian Empire, and it didn't get any borders at all until after the Bolshevik Revolution, and then it got its borders. Now, how does that make these borders sacred?
Well, a lot of these situations, this is, again, the hypocrisy that we've seen. I think correctly, in places like Yugoslavia, after Tito's demise, there were these ancient rivalries that broke out. And you had people coming from Orthodox Christianity to Muslims, and you had different ethnic and religious groups going to war with each other. And one of the solutions to that, ultimately, after a lot of terrible violence, was to say, okay, we'll have different states. We'll break it up a bit so people can more or less be among a group that is essentially more homogeneous than it was. Now, that's, as Americans, I think we like to see that people should be able to get together. We operate in a very diverse country ourselves. But some of these places, they have these ancient hatreds that are very real to them. Even if something happened in the 1300s, it can be very real to some of these people, perhaps more real than what they're doing today. So sometimes you do have to look at ways to divide countries. In the case of Ukraine, you have a country that is pretty evenly split between the more ethnic Russian East and the more, what you might call pure Ukrainian West. And the pure Ukrainian West also includes some of these neo-Nazis who believe in a pure Ukrainian blood, in effect. And that's why they formed the Galician SS and fought with Adolf Hitler's forces during World War II. So you have ancient rivalries, but also things that go back 70 years or so to the World War II, where there was this tremendous hatred among these different people. It gets sort of papered over as it's under the Soviet Union days. But when the Soviet Union collapses, you then have this country that is now politically divided, and you've had this struggle going on for 20-some years. You had the Orange Revolution, which was another effort by the Western Ukrainians to take power, and they sort of did for a while, but then that collapsed, and Yanukovych gets elected from the East. And so you have this political struggle going on, and really the last thing these folks needed probably was to have the Westerners come in and try to stir it up. But that's what's happened, mm-hmm. And now you've got the Russians stirring it up. So you have a real a humanitarian disaster on your hands, rather than letting the political solutions work out. If you remember back on February 21st of last year, Yanukovych signed an agreement with three European countries, Poland, France, and Germany, guaranteeing it. And that agreement was that he would take reduced powers. He accepted the demands of many of the Maidan demonstrators. He agreed to early elections so he could be voted out of office. But instead of letting that political solution move forward, the radicals in the Maidan saw their opening and they struck. And it was a coup d'etat. And instead of the Western Europeans saying, we made a deal, we agreed to something, instead, very quickly, the United States and the European Union accepted as legitimate this new regime that took over. And I think there could have been a case where if they could have made the February 21st agreement stick, vote Yanukovych out of office. That's the way it's supposed to work.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, it went to this violent stage, and it's just gotten worse and worse.
Well, right now the big story is that the Ukrainians have had to leave Debaltseve, and in some disarray, although the media kind of downplayed that for a while and said nothing about Ukrainian deserters. Apparently, a lot of Ukrainians are deserting and going to Russia. And so it's a huge defeat. And you add that to, some of these other wars that our neocons have been pushing. Right now, Libya comes to mind, that's collapsing entirely. It's like, Yeah, it makes you think of those old Laurel and Hardy movies, you know, where Oliver Hardy said, "Here's another fine mess you got us into." But somehow the neocons are still taken seriously. You know, they get on all the talk shows and everything else. How has that happened?
Well, they're very influential. I've been dealing with the neocons really since they sort of emerged in the late 70s, early 80s. I knew many of them. I dealt with them when I was with the Associated Press covering Central America. A lot of them had been Reagan sort of put them there, people like Elliot Abrams, Robert Kagan, et cetera. I guess you could say Reagan was smart enough not to put them in the Middle East. That changed when George W. Bush came in and we brought people like Elliot Abrams back and basically gave him the Middle East. So the neocons, you know, went ahead with their agenda, which they've been developing since the 90s, of what they call regime change. And their plan was to sort of get rid of some troublesome leaders in the Middle East, people like Saddam Hussein, people like Assad in Syria, people like the leadership in Iran. They wanted to do regime change, not sort of work with anybody, not negotiate, just get rid of them. And they got their way in Iraq, and we saw what happened. And we still see the catastrophe that has left us with, not only the hundreds of thousands of dead, but these super radical groups roaming around, causing more mayhem. The neocons thought in 2013, in September, they were going to get the United States to start bombing the Assad regime in Syria, which is another regime change, even though we now know that if that had happened, likely we'd have either the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda's Nusra Front running Damascus right now, because the only real force stopping them was the Assad's military. But they didn't get that. And the one reason they didn't get that is because Putin worked behind the scenes with Obama to get the Assad government, if you remember, to give up all its chemical weapons. And that became the political solution, but it infuriated the neocons and really put Putin on their radar. And they began then looking at Ukraine. We start seeing them talking about Ukraine as late September of 2013. Carl Gershman, the head of the National Endowment for Democracy, a leading neocon, he runs essentially a $100 million slush fund for the neocons. And he started talking about calling Ukraine the biggest prize. He had scores of operations going in Ukraine, training activists, paying journalists, the whole nine yards. And then you started seeing Victoria Nuland coming in to sort of, you know, she, as they say, midwife this thing.
And her husband.
You had this another regime change that happens, mm-hmm. and we see the catastrophe that's been left, the chaos, the unnecessary deaths all across Ukraine. The conservative estimates are in the 5,000-6,000 range, but some say it's more like 50,000.
Mm-hmm. How come these people have so much influence in the Obama administration? That's one question. And what does it look like in 2016 if Hillary is running for the Democrats? I mean, where does this leave us?
Well, Obama never really took control of his foreign policy. Mm-hmm. I would say, based on my reporting, that Obama is what you might call a closet realist, that he wants to sort of work these things out, but is not very assertive. He sort of hides in the closet. From the very beginning, if you remember, he had this idea of the team of rivals, they called it. So he kept on George Bush's defense secretary, Robert Gates, who is not really a neocon, but works very, very closely with the neocons and has worked over the years with them. Then you had the high command saying the same. People like General Petraeus, who I would say is a neocon and works very close with leading neocons. Obama put in Hillary Clinton in as Secretary of State, and she, you might call her a neocon light. She was very much in line with the neocons and most of their views. Very hawkish Democrat, as you would say. So she's the one who promoted people like Victoria Nuland. Mm-hmm. Who had worked for Vice President Cheney and was married to Robert Kagan, one of the leading neocons in Washington, and she herself is a leading neocon. So Obama never really took control of his foreign policy. He tried to work kind of behind the scenes, But he was often outmaneuvered by them because they're very clever. They're very powerful. They have all kinds of relationships with key editors at major news organizations. The Washington Post, for instance, is really run by neoconservatives. They have all these think tanks. They have all this funding that goes into it. So they have a real grasp on official Washington, mm-hmm. and that goes on whoever's in power. And Obama's never really come in and said, "I'm going to do it my way." He's play ball, he's sort of finessed, and he's gotten rolled more
well,
often than not.
Boy, it does not bode well for the future. Well, thank you very much. We've been talking to Robert Parry, the editor and publisher of Consortium News, where you can go to find out more. If you want to know more about Ukraine, that is one of the places to go. So thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
And stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
That's right, Air Cascadia is coming up also today on KBOO Portland at 10:15, Flashpoints with a look at the recent violent attacks against Muslims in the United States, an interview about the possible impact of the election of the leftist Syriza party in Greece on the U.S. economy, and a look at the increasing numbers of self-immolation by Buddhist monks in Tibet. And 11:30 on the Radio Zine, Paul Rowland speaks with Helena Norberg Hodge. Actually, before that, at 11 on Between the Covers, Coast Ken Jones speaks with Joshua Samuel Brown, author of the new book, How Not to Avoid Jet Lag and Other Tales of Travel Madness. Then at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, host Paul Rowland speaks with Helena Norberg Hodge, director of Local Futures, author of Ancient Futures, and producer of the Economics of Happiness film about the upcoming Economics of Happiness conference in Portland. That is all coming up after we hear from Chris Andre, hosting Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary coming right up on KBOO. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you missed our recent membership drive, you can still join by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.